have the Judiciary Committee will come to order at 2 p.m. on Monday, March 26th, 2012. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Paskin is here, Senator Coghill, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator French. Three bills up today, SB 168, SB 198, SB 138, just good luck, I guess, 3698. It's my intention to hear and hold them, although I think SB 168 will be ready to move on soon. So let's start with that one. It's the it's a Judiciary Committee bill. It deals with the cost of living salary adjustments for justices of the Supreme Court. We have a new CS/M before us. There can be a motion to adopt that.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilikowski has moved /M before us. Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, that'll be the bill we'll work off of. And let's have Mr. Williver come forward. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Wolver. I'm the Deputy Director of the Alaska Court System. When the court asked the legislature to introduce Senate Bill 168, it did occur to us that it might get amended along the way. And one of the possible amendments we envisioned at that time was this version that you have before you now, which it's the simplest amendment to the statute that gives and still gives judges a significant increase in the geographic differential. It's not as much as other state employees, either union employees or non-union employees. But because judges do have a higher salary than others, the amount of the differential in dollar terms is pretty similar to what other well-compensated state employees get in those same communities. The court supports the amendment and asks your favorable consideration of the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Wolver. Questions for Mr. Wolver? Explain, I mean, just so the public understands, on line 7 of page 1, we've deleted the first 40,000 of. What effect does that have on the fiscal impact of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, fiscal, it increases the current cost of the program. From 73,000, which is what is currently in our budget now. This is the 17% of $40,000 is 7,000. That's the maximum a judge can receive. That, if you add that whole thing up, that costs $73,399 a year. What this, our original bill, which adopted the same geographic differential as other non-covered employees get in the state, would have cost just shy of $800,000. What this version does is costs, I think my letter to you says $241,199. It's actually $249,199, which is why I shouldn't write things without an editor. But
we'll make that notation on.
Yeah,
our
never.
$249,199.
That's what the two fiscal notes, Mr. Chairman, add up to. It's just in my letter to you, I hit a 1 rather than a 9, but so right now judges get a maximum of $7,000 under this version of the bill. That 17.5% doesn't apply to only the first 40,000. It applies to their salary.
Okay, so the original bill raised it to make it apply. It had a greater increase.
Yes, right. Mr. Chairman.
And this one has
much
a
much greater.
Yeah, much greater. And this one removes the $40,000 cap, but has a smaller increase, thus reducing the size of the fiscal note.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions for Mr. Waller?
Senator Paskin. Who came up with that concept of doing it this way, and what's the reason for that?
Well, through the chair, Senator Paskin, this is an amendment that is being contemplated on the House side where this bill is. There are any number of different ways we could have structured this that we thought of ahead of time, and our fiscal office came out with a lot of different scenarios. We could have applied the non-covered percentages but capped it at 80,000 or capped it at 40,000 or capped it at 100,000 or we could have done any number of different things. This was one of them. This, I don't know why necessarily, I haven't heard why the House is considering this particular amendment, other than it's a very simple amendment, and it gets them pretty close to where others are. But I don't know. And that bill, that amendment has not been adopted. But I'm running out of time on this bill, and
that's partly why we're here. I mean, we were, I think a lot of us felt some sticker shock at the initial proposal. We saw the House taking an approach that seemed rational. We've adopted it here. I'm interested in moving the bill out Wednesday once we've had a day or so to think this over. Because if we do nothing, then judges get nothing. And I think most of us agree that the current system is a little too penurious when it comes to compensating judges who serve outside of Anchorage in high-cost areas like Barrow, Kotzebue, and Nome.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cockhill.
So I see that Dillingham has been pulled out and put into the 17.5 range. Kodiak, too. I'm sorry. Kodiak as well. And my guess is that's a transportation plus housing issue.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, when this statute was adopted, and I think this, in terms of where these districts, which courts, communities it applies to, was adopted, I think, in 1978, Dillingham didn't have a Superior Court judge. So it's, the statute's never been adopted, never been updated. So now we've got an allowance for Dillingham, which gets the same geographic differential as Bethel.
Further questions? Hearing and seeing none. Have we taken public testimony on this?
We've not closed it.
We haven't closed it. Anyone else here in the room want to testify on SB 168? Anyone online want to testify? With that, we'll close public testimony. We'll hold the bill over till Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're still on the record. I just banged the gavel because we're changing bills. Let's go to 198 now. CS for Senate Bill 198. We do have another CS before us, / E for ECHO. Senator Wilkowski.
Chairman, I would move version / ECHO as the version before us.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, we will work on / ECHO. Senator Wilkowski, why don't you tell us what's in the new CS?
I'd like to call my staff for forward, please.
Please.
Hello. For the record, my name is Thomas Presley, intern for Senator Wilkowski. There is one change to this CS for SB 198 in that Section 4 was removed. Previously, the bill made polygraph testing during employment, investigative polygraph testing, took that power away from the department. That was not the intent of the bill. The intent was only to give police officers the right to refuse to take a polygraph test and not be punished for that decision. So Section 4 was removed, and now the department may still ask for investigative polygraph test. Police officers now continue to retain the right to refuse to take that test.
Without punishment.
Correct.
Excellent. Any other changes?
Just that one.
Just the
Mr.
one.
Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I am sorry. I do not have that.
No / ECHO?
I do not have it.
We
sorry.
Take a short at ease.
I am so sorry.
Now we're back on the record, and we have a motion before the committee to adopt backslash E as the working version. And I think we actually granted the motion, so the version is before us, but all members now have the version. And we've been told that this version simply removes the former Section 4 of the bill dealing with polygraphs. Further questions about the CS? I think there's some folks who still want to testify about this, and so nobody online. Does the Police Standards Council wish to be heard about the new CS?
We wouldn't have any different testimony on that.
Testimony the same as before? How about PSCA?
No.
Same testimony as before? Very good. Senator Rutkowski, you were engaged with in some conversations with both PSCA and the Police Standards Council. Any movement on some of the issues in the bill, or folks kind of dug in and waiting to see what happens?
I think
I have to put you on the spot. And, you know, and if you don't want to make a representation on the record, you don't have to.
But there still may be some differences, Mr. Chairman.
Differences remain?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't we do this? Why don't we hold the bill for one more hearing, and if there's been nothing else changed on Wednesday, we'll move it out then. But I'm always hoping that, you know, folks can come to terms.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. We've made changes from the very first time that we've had hearings on this, and to try to bring the parties closer together. And I think at some point we're just going to have to make a policy call.
Right. That's why we get the big bucks. All right, let's go ahead and set this bill aside then. And I'm not going to bang the gavel, but we will turn to SB 138. And I think we do not have a new CS on this one, but we got a good 10-minute overview on the bill at the last hearing, a good strong PowerPoint, and we heard from Marie Darling from AARP about cramming. One question I've had, which is, you know, this affects landlines, not cell phones, correct?
The fact is on both landlines and cell phones, but our bill is limited to the chair to landlines.
I see. So it can happen to both, but you're only focusing on landlines.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And how prevalent is the problem here in Alaska?
To the chair, that's inconclusive right now. We've asked the Attorney General as well as the Better Business Bureau for any records that they have, and they've come back with a couple. But one of the issues with phone cramming in general is the low level of consumer awareness. The 1 in 20 people is what the FCC estimated. So it's kind of hard to get a positive number on how many Alaskans are affected right now.
Right. I mean, I pay my phone bill. I look at it. Sometimes I actually read it. Most times I don't. Most of the times when I do read it, I come away thinking, I guess that's right.
And, you know? And that is often the case that was cited in many reports, that especially with the advent of electronic bills and no longer paper bills, many people are not taking the time to read through all the pages to figure out.
Sure. You see the number. You go to your electronic banking portal. You transfer some money, and you're done. So we do have folks lined up to testify. Why don't we go ahead and turn to them? There's nothing else from the sponsor or the staff. Thank you. We have three people sent up to testify, Craig Graziano, Matt Wallace, and Deborah Cook. Why don't you each take about 3 to 5 minutes and tell us why you're for or against the bill. Let's start with Craig Graziano.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Craig Graziano. I'm an attorney with the Office of Consumer Advocate in the Iowa Department of Justice. I also chair the Consumer Protection Committee for the National Association of State Utility Consumer Advocates. I'm very pleased to address you today regarding the experience in Iowa with respect to the cramming of unauthorized charges onto consumer phone bills. In Iowa, we've had a statute and regulation on the books since 1999. They prohibit unauthorized changes in telecommunications service, including both third-party and first-party cramming. They authorize the Iowa Utilities Board to assess civil monetary penalties up to $10,000 per violation. The statute excludes wireless billings. As a result, our experience is largely confined to wireline billings. That's not to say, as you just said, that the problem is confined to wireline billings. Our office has had a steady enforcement effort in place for a decade. Over the years, we have filed hundreds of petitions against scores of companies. Most of the cases have settled upon terms including a modest civil monetary penalty, typically $1,500 today. We think the penalties take the profit out of the offending practices. They also have a beneficial sentinel effect that extends beyond the individual company and throughout the industry. Since our effort began, the volume of complaints has declined markedly. Some types of complaints appear to have dried up entirely. I have several illustrations from our complaints. I'll give you an abbreviated version of them, given the time constraint. In one case, a collect call was supposedly accepted on a fax line at a school at 4 a.m. on Sunday. In a second case, a series of calls from a sex hotline was supposedly received at the home of a 65-year-old grandmother who lived alone. The company provided a voice recording supposedly showing that the call had been accepted by a male who identified himself as Marcus Welby. In a third case, the consumer advised that a voice recording had been doctored to make it appear an authorization had been given when in fact an authorization had not been given. And in a recent federal, we've seen a lot of complaints like that. In a recent federal court case in California, the court noted tens of thousands of fraudulently manufactured sales. In a fourth case, the company had supposedly obtained a birth date as a validation of an alleged internet order. The consumer advised that he graduated from high school the year before the proposed birth date. According to the company, the order nevertheless passed its validation test because the IP address from which the order came was within 100 miles of the consumer's street address. Federal Communications Commission later issued an order proposing a forfeiture of $3 million against this same company for alleged cramming violations of the same character. What all of this tells us is that the company instituted a supposed validation system that does not validate. Contrast a PIN number system in which, if I put a wrong PIN number in, the system bounces back invalid PIN number and the transaction is rejected rather than approved. Our experience suggests that many consumers never notice the unauthorized charges and hence that the complaints are the tip of an iceberg. Before closing, I wanted to share two additional observations. First, it has long been my view that the states are the best forum in which to seek to stop the problem. They are close to the complainants. They often have the resources both to assist the victims and to institute enforcement proceedings. There is also a history on the role of the states. In the 1990s, state public utility commissions and state attorneys general, in actions affecting nearly 400,000 consumers, ordered carriers to pay at least $13.4 million in restitution and at least $4.1 million in penalties for cramming and slamming violations. That's according to the U.S. Government Accountability Office. For reasons such as these, I think the efforts such as yours are precisely what is needed most. Lastly, it's important to be wary when you write exceptions into your statute so as not to exclude the very things you were trying to reach, and I have a pretty good example of that from Iowa, but in the interest of time, I'll spare you that. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Mr. Graziano, Senator Paskin has a question, and then I do.
Do you have an understanding as to whether these companies that are engaged in the cramming are U.S.-based or whether they're offshore or international?
Well, I know that many of the telemarketers are offshore. In the federal court case that I mentioned, the court observed that there were about 20 different telemarketing firms involved that were producing these manufactured sales, and all but one of them were located in India or the Philippines. Most of the companies who actually put the charges on have domestic addresses. Whether their operations are located here, I don't know.
And do you know whether the $3 million penalty, as I understand it was, how that compares to the dollars collected? In other words, is it the tip of the iceberg? Was there access to their financial records so that there's, what's the relative magnitude of the $3 million as compared to the magnitude of the cramming?
That was the FCC's case. I don't know how comprehensive that was or how correlated the penalty was to the amount of damage. I do know that there were, the same day, there were three other companies that were penalized in similar fashion for similar violations by the FCC.
And I have a question, Mr. Graziano. In your work on this subject, have you do you think that the Crammers are aware of which states have strong laws against this and which states don't, and act accordingly, or do you think they're just sort of targeting at random?
I think there is a good deal of awareness of our enforcement effort. I mentioned that our numbers have gone down significantly over the years. I've had discussions with companies and lawyers on the other side indicating that rather than continue to face our enforcement effort, they would rather just leave the state.
Interesting. Thank you very much for your testimony. I don't see any other questions. I appreciate you making yourself available today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Next up is Matt Wallace. Matt Wallace, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Please put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, or ACTRG. We're a nonpartisan member-driven consumer protection organization, and one of our key focuses is working on behalf of our members to stop tricks and traps in the marketplace that can trap consumers and really come in their pocketbooks. I won't obviously overview the issue too much since there was such a good presentation and an overview of the issue last time. I did just want to highlight a couple of the facts that we think are most salient. One is just estimates about how widespread the practice is, potentially netting up to about $2 billion a year nationwide. Also reiterating that while this problem's been around for a long time, the voluntary system set up by telephone companies has failed to solve the problem. And of course, it's also worth noting that to some extent, telephone companies do profit from cramming by charging fees to those third parties and third party aggregators, generating substantial revenue. We view Senate Bill 138 as a very straightforward solution to a pretty straightforward problem. And something where legislation like this can be a really proactive step towards stopping basically scam artists from ripping off Alaskan consumers. I will, of course, also note there's a fair amount of motion nationwide moving forward on this, and has been for some time. And of course, in addition to the regulations passed a decade ago in Iowa. More recently, Vermont has passed very strong legislation banning this practice. Illinois is considering legislation now, which I believe recently passed their House of Representatives unanimously. There's federal legislation pending introduction that would also ban this practice entirely. And also this month, the Verizon phone company, as a result of a class action lawsuit, voluntarily pledged to end this practice of unauthorized third-party charges. So it's true that it's difficult to surmise the full impact of this problem in Alaska precisely because the fees are often so well hidden and so well buried in the fine print. Our office has received several calls over the last couple of months as we've started engaging the public on this issue, asking questions about their phone bills. I don't have the results of any of those investigations to present to you today. And again, part of that is because it can often be very difficult to tell, what is one of these grand charges and what isn't. I'll wrap up my comments there and again just say, on behalf of our members, we think this is a good, straightforward bill. We look forward in the future to investigating the problem more comprehensively when it comes to the wireless market, but this is definitely a huge first step, common sense solution, and we strongly urge your support. And with that, I'll end my comments and happy to take any questions if there are any.
Mr. Wallace, thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I don't see any questions. No questions. We have Cindy Drinkwater also online to answer questions. She's an attorney with the Department of Law, Consumer Protection. The last witness who wants to testify or sign up to testify is Deborah Cook. Ms. Cook, are you there?
I am.
Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Cook. I'm representing Alaska Communications on Senate Bill 138. I'm currently the Senior Manager of Billing and Collections. I've been asked to read a letter and suggested amendments forwarded to Senator French by our Vice President of Legal, Regulatory, and Government Affairs, Leonard Steinberg. It obviously starts, dear Senator French, Alaska Communications discourages further action on CSSB 138. However, if further action is taken by Senate Judiciary Committee, Alaska Communications recommends a few amendments which are attached to the letter. If enacted, SB 138 would place new burdens on telecommunications providers that provide third-party billing services. Alaskan Communications opposes this legislation because there is no evidence of a problem in this area that needs fixing. We are not aware of any consumer rebellion tied to third-party billing. We do not have a large inbox filled with complaints, and we are not aware of this being an issue for telecommunications providers in Alaska. For those reasons, we see no need for legislation. Alaska Communications does bill consumers and customers for third parties. At the same time, it bills for its own services. Customers do short pay bills when they inform us of the reason. We allocate the funds submitted appropriately. Too often, however, customers fail to explain why the bill is short paid or how to allocate the funds they submit. In the absence of any information from the customer, Alaska Communications applies a rational allocation of funds between itself and the third parties. This can lead to non-payment of telephone bills through no fault of the telephone provider. Alaska Communications takes its responsibility to provide quality services very seriously. Customers, too, however, need to be responsible and explain why they have short paid the bill and how to allocate any funds submitted. Therefore, although Alaska Communications sees no need for this legislation, we will submit the attached proposed amendments providing for customer responsibilities for your consideration. And that was by Leonard Steinberg. The suggested amendments in Section 1-4205715 add new subsection. Telecommunications carriers may recover the reasonable cost of implementing bill changes and other related costs associated with this section from the person or billing agent covered by this section. Section 4205715 add a new subsection to invoke the non-discontinuous of service protection described in this subsection. A customer must inform the telecommunications carrier in writing that a billing dispute exists. A customer makes a partial payment to telecommunications carrier by subtracting a disputed amount, must inform the telecommunications carrier in writing of that fact, and instruct the telecommunications carrier how to provide, apply the payment. A customer's failure to prescribe payment application allows the telecommunications provider to apply payments in accordance with its standard practices. In this circumstance, payment delinquencies could prompt the discontinuation of services, telecommunications services. Section 4550476, add a new subsection C. Telecommunications carriers have no obligation to independently verify the accuracy of information provided by the vendor of goods and services under this subsection. I'm happy to answer any questions on this that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. I think we'll have some questions. I appreciate your making yourself available to us. Senator Pascman.
Yes, I was wondering whether you monitor your billings that are distributed to your customers for evidence of cramming that might occur in the billing.
We actually do. Thanks for your question. We do, and have changed some of our billing practices because of that. I also have, or in Alaska Communications, we have a fraud department where customers can complain about various billing items, and we investigate that fully and get back to the customer, in most cases, to their satisfaction. I don't believe we've had more than two that we've not resolved in the past year to the customer's satisfaction. So we're validating the billings as they go out. We're being very careful who we allow to be third-party providers, what type of calls we're taking. For instance, 800 calls are turned without question. If a customer says that and those are what I heard earlier in testimony, where they may be a sex client or whatever. If a customer calls in and says that is not something that they did, we return those to the third-party providers without even question.
Senator Passman.
Just as kind of a general follow-up, you know, when it comes to these fraudulent transactions on a consumer's bill, you know, the balance at some point has to be between how does it get on the business's bill and what is the business's customer's obligation to the extent that they find a fraudulent charge. And, you know, so that's that conundrum, I guess, that I'm trying to weigh is, you know, how do you allow a third-party vendor to put a charge on your bill to begin with? What has to be done? Is there a contractual relationship, or how does that process occur?
There is a contractual relationship. We ask for that with all of our vendors so that we have quality information on where billing is coming from. We become then the customer's advocate for third-party questions in my department, which is the final billing and collections. We have also the fraud area where we can validate for the customer, but the customer's responsibility of letting us know if you see something on the bill. Obviously, third-party carriers can send us billing that would go on the bill. We wouldn't know if it was valid or not without the customer saying something to us, and I believe that's what we're asking for, is just to validate that customers give us the opportunity to be aware if they're short paying, be aware if there's a problem, and understand so that we can be their advocate.
Ms. Cook, I have actually Senator Passman has one more question. Go ahead.
You know, I guess just what I'm trying to figure out is, do you do a substantive investigation into the third-party billing entity that you're contracting with, and does your company get a piece of the action?
I think I understand what you mean by piece of the action, but contracts have prices that come into play, and obviously for us to bill for any provider, there are costs that are associated with that. But we do background checks and validation of that provider prior to them becoming someone that would put something on our billing. Does that better answer the question?
Yeah, I'm just trying to, again, find out if there is a substantive inquiry and, you know, as part of that contractual relationship, or whether it's just a template you sign up and they say they accept and then they're on your billing cycle and there's not been a substantive inquiry as part of that. And then as I understand, there may be some billing relationship that arises out of that. So I'm just trying to better understand that.
I apologize if I didn't explain this well. The inquiry is credit validation of previous services. We rarely sign up new third-party individuals that want to bill on wireless billing. We do have several long-standing contracts out there, but they've been thoroughly vetted before we put them into the billing system. And yes, there are contractual obligations once we do billing for someone.
And Ms. Cook, maybe you can just give me a little bit of fill this out for me. What's a typical third party for whom you're billing? Is there such a thing? Or just give me maybe some more mainstream examples besides the sex hotlines.
Sure. One that we bill for on a regular basis would be 800 lines. If someone wants to have 800 lines come in, and they can be for anything. We do third-party billing. There's an area out there where folks want to have automated billing for family members that may be incarcerated. We do that billing. We do directory billing for directory advertising. All of those we make sure, again, are thoroughly vetted before we do that, so they're not a fly-by-night company that hopefully we've caught anything ahead of time.
Okay, so And just give me an idea of what sort of volume that represents for your company. How much money is moving? And I guess Senator Pasquin asked, but maybe I didn't hear the question. I'm sorry, I have a head cold or the answer. But do you get a, if I have an 800 number and you're charging me to have people call me, do I pay ACS? I mean, I assume you must make some money from this.
800 is actually more going away, but we do a little bit. The issue with 800 at this point is we, with any question on an 800 line, we automatically return it to the carrier, which is one of the reasons that 800 has become less and less profitable for any company. People have moved to wireless and away from 800 lines. I couldn't give you the exact figures on third-party billing. I'm happy to get back with you on what we have, but our biggest right now third-party contract would probably be our directory contract. And with the directory contract, individuals have to have signed contracts with that partner, the Berry company. And if they do not, we are, again, the advocate with the Berry company to find resolution and identify any incorrect billing on that.
Thank you. Those are my questions. Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you charge for third-party enhanced services that are not telephone-related?
I apologize. Such as?
We've heard some testimony about things like diet services, for example.
Oh, okay. Actually, it's been about 5 years now that we shared with the different providers that we were working with that we would no longer bill for those things, and that includes items like magazines, and we found that at that time we were seeing an increase on problematic potential contracts, and so we opted not to bill for those providers for that reason.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Pasquin.
Just in a general sense, there's two issues here. One is the landlines, and then the other is the cell phones, and trying to get your reasonable assurance that somehow or another in this contractual investigation that you enter into that you're doing, so to speak, a job in the consumer's interest to eliminate that potential for the crammers to get their billings on your bill that you send to the consumer. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. I wouldn't say it was only in our best interest. I believe that, or for the consumer's best interest, I would believe it would be both. Obviously, we don't want our name associated with inappropriate billing. We believe very strongly in that, and I do, having been the billing manager now for the last 12 years. When we identify areas of concern, we address them as quickly as we can to remove them from the billing.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
So if this bill passes without some of the ideas that you propose as an amendment, the responsibility falls on you, but it sounds like you've already put yourself in a kind of a contractual position. But if you couldn't get kind of the input from the customer you wanted, would you then start going away from these third-party services, or would there be some other avenue that you would start ramping up?
I think we are going away from them as we move forward. They're less and less in our organization anyway, something that we seek out to bill, wanting it to be more of a pure telecommunications bill on the wireline. Absolutely. We've headed down that path. The amendments help to make the customer aware that it is difficult for us to know there's a problem without customer input. Not that we're trying to tie anyone's hands. I believe as soon as we identify that there is an issue, we take action. So the amendments are designed to ensure that customers know that they need to share with us their concerns.
Okay, and follow-up, Senator?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and just, Ms. Cook, just maybe just going back to sort of to bedrock from a consumer's perspective, the charges, I'm a customer at ACS, the charges on my phone line have all been put there because I've agreed to them, right? I mean, whether they're through you or through a third party, there's some sort of positive act on my behalf or act by
correct.
Me that said yes to the service.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Pascan.
Is that more than oral? Because what we heard here is some of the fabrications of the oral representation. In other words, I know with the Berry Company and the advertising that I get from, you know, from ACS, that I have that in contract with the Berry Company, and then they, through you, send me the bill every month. So that's in writing, but it's the issues of what isn't in writing that I think is a concern. Are all of those representations of the consumer in writing?
They're not all in writing. They can be oral, that is documented via some sort of capture of voice recording. It is the ones, those are more the ones that I think we spend a little more time investigating. We prefer written contracts and would prefer them for, but understand as a telecommunications organization, sometimes in some of the more remote areas, it's difficult to get a written contract or a signed written contract, so oral is all we have. But we do investigate those, and as I said, we spend a little bit of time doing that. We have a group that is their secondary function is just to investigate those. If any complaint arises based on any type of billing that they don't believe is theirs, more often than not, it was either a misunderstanding. The customer thought they were getting something else as opposed to what they got. And even with that, we have the ability to help correct those for them.
One last question. In the area of your payment to the third-party contractor that you're dealing with, how long of a turnover period is that from when the bill appears on the customer's bill until you pay that third-party contractor?
I apologize that where that's paid is out of a different department, and I don't have that answer. I believe it's anywhere from 60 to 120 days. But I would need to validate that.
Okay. Further questions for Ms. Cook? Ms. Cook, thank you. Obviously, we had a lot of interest in this, and I appreciate you making yourself available to us.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
You're welcome. Senator Wilikowski.
Ms. Chair, if we're done with public testimony,
I think let's find out. That's a good idea. Let's find out. Anybody else on the line who wants to testify about SB 138.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question.
Senator Coghill. Well, okay, go ahead.
I probably should have chimed up earlier, but what ACS was saying on suggested language, did they send that to us by way of
letter?
Okay, all right.
Yep.
I just hadn't seen it yet.
Should be in your packet, and I'll make sure the bill's not moving today, so we'll make sure you get a copy.
Thank you.
If you didn't get it. So anything else on that? Senator Wilikowski?
From Ms. Drinkwater.
Ms. Drinkwater, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me all right?
Sure can. Put yourself on the record if you would.
My name is Cynthia Drinkwater, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Unit at the Department of Law.
Great, and thanks for making yourself available. Any response to some of the testimony you've heard here today?
Mr. Chairman, would it be possible if there's a question? I'm just concerned about offering information or opinion that's not specifically requested.
Okay, well, let me first ask whether the administration supports this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not in a position to offer support or not. I'm available for questions and if there are any legal issues that might be of concern to the committee.
Okay, hold on. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for calling in, Ms. Drinkwater. Can you talk a little bit about the brief that, or the memo that was signed by the Attorney General for the State of Alaska to the regarding the FCC action?
Certainly, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, in October of 2011, a number of states' attorneys general signed on to comments to the FCC regarding a notice of proposed rulemaking having to do with telephone cramming. And Alaska was one of the states that signed on to that letter. The letter primarily urged the FCC to consider a ban on third-party charges on third parties putting charges on telephone bills. There was a recognition that if the FCC didn't want to consider an outright ban, that it'd be a ban with certain exceptions, such as for telephone-related services, collect calls, inmate calls, and those sorts of things. As an alternative to the ban, the comments also advocated for affirmative action by consumers before any billing occurs. In other words, to create a system where consumers would opt in to a particular vendor's charge so that it would be done on a vendor-by-vendor basis. As opposed to having, essentially the current situation where consumers are billed and then they have to opt out by calling their carrier to have charges taken off their bills.
Mr. Quarter, can you lean in a little closer to your microphone? We're having trouble picking you up for the recording.
Certainly. Would you like me to repeat anything, or was it sufficient?
We're okay. It's just we just don't want to lose your testimony. Thank you. Further questions for Ms. Drinkwater, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah. Does this bill address some of the concerns that the Parnell administration advocated for in the letter that they sent to the FCC?
Well, certainly to the purpose of the bill, certainly to reduce unwanted charges on phone bills, to stop cramming, that is consistent with the comments. I think that the possible concern would be that there, for instance, is the potential for some unlawful or improper practices to continue. I've talked with Mr. Presley about some of my concerns. For instance, as it stands now, one of the ways that charges can be placed on bills is occurs when there is third-party verification. And I think without some definition, the danger would be that some of the abuses that Mr. Graziano and others have talked about could still occur because there's so much room for abusive practices, including the doctoring of telephone recordings or failure to actually verify that a particular consumer has agreed to the service. But as the bill is also, I think, does provide for some steps that would assist in enforcing unlawful cramming. For instance, the requirement that, as I understand it, that vendors or billing aggregators would have to provide proof to the carriers of express authorization. That would be of assistance in an investigation because we could subpoena or otherwise obtain that proof of express authorization from the carriers, as opposed to having to chase down vendors or billing aggregators that are located out of state and may be very difficult to find.
Senator Pasquin has a question.
As I understand, then you would find this beneficial to the extent that the Attorney General's office was, uncovered evidence of a pattern of abuse of Alaskans by a cramming company, that this would then authorize the Attorney General's office to commence an action under 4550-471B, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Passman, that's correct. I believe that we would have some authority to proceed on a cramming investigation under any circumstances, but this bill would be of assistance in one way that I outlined previously, that it would make it easier to obtain the records of a customer's authorization if it, in fact, was given.
Senator Passman, yeah.
In other words, what other methods would you have to proceed as to an unlawful act or deceptive act unless it's under 4550-471B?
Under the Consumer Protection Act, there are, let me step back for a second. The kinds of unlawful acts that are listed in B are not exclusive. In other words, there can be an unlawful or deceptive act or practice that exists without being specifically listed. There is benefit to a specific listing because it makes it easier to show that there has been a violation.
Okay. I understand.
Senator Wilkowski, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And when the Parnell administration sent their letter along with 15 other state attorney generals urging the FCC to outright ban cramming, third-party cramming, what was the rationale that they gave for that?
So reasoning behind the comments were consistent with the comments that have been made by others today and in previous hearings to address the problem of telephone cramming, to stop practices whereby customers are getting billed for services that they didn't authorize or agree to.
Senator Coghill has a question.
And thank you for working in the consumer protection area. So presently, if a third-party billing becomes a legal action, or if you see a scam happening, do you go after the billing agent, for example, ACS or one of the phone companies, and have them then go after the fraudulent third party, or is that something that you can go past the biller to the third party?
Through the chair, I have to apologize. I'm not sure I completely understood your question, Senator. The billing, I might be confused by whether you're referring to the billing aggregator that collects the bills and then contacts the carrier, or if you're talking about the carrier.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to get at is, presently under our present law, I'm trying to figure out why would we want to do this. If I have somebody let's just say the billing agent has not been able to catch, and you have these continuing fraudulent third-party bills that plague customers in Alaska, what tools do you have? Do you go after the billing agent like ACS, or can you now, under our present law, go after those third-party vendors, or do you have to go to the billing agents? Kind of what I was looking at under our present law.
Well, as it currently exists, again through the chair, we would have the full panoply of tools we have when we're conducting an investigation. We have the ability to issue subpoenas or civil investigative demands. The difficulty sometimes with cramming investigations is that it's difficult to find the parties who are placing charges on the bills.
Mr. Chairman, so do you find that as a fault of the people who do the billing, or do you find that somebody else's fault?
Senator, through the chair, I should also make clear that our office does not have, I wouldn't say we have extensive experience with these types of investigations. But in my my somewhat limited experience, the problem is more finding the vendor.
Okay. Then the other question I have, Mr. Chairman, is so we're dealing with landlines here, and cell phones, smartphones are just exploding in usage. Is this going to be a diminishing effort compared to what's going on in the cell phone world, or do we have the same issue at a different level with smartphones?
Through the chair, my understanding is that certainly it's going to be just, I think it's expected that ramming on cell phones is going to be, that we'll see increases in that in the future. But at the same time, we're also aware that it is a practice that happens on landlines, and as I believe Mr. Presley indicated in an earlier hearing, it may be that because people are switching more towards wireless, that they tend to look less at their landlines,
so
at their bills for landlines.
So, Mr. Chairman, maybe one other question. The ACS, I think, said to us that they would like to see the customer have more responsibility in telling what those charges were and maybe defending why they want someone to take it off. Is that a burden that is reasonable? Is that something that you see as something that needs to be a part of this bill? Or do you think that the people who do the contracting, say like the billing vendor, carries more of the responsibility?
Through the chair, I'm afraid I'm not really in a position to comment on that. That's the first time I've heard that concern that customers aren't passing on that information to their carriers. So I'm not sure I could add anything further to the question.
Senator Paspe, I guess the last question.
Sure, if I could follow up on Senator Coghill's question. Do you believe that the company has an obligation or a duty to screen the third-party vendors? I think that that's in part what Senator Coghill was trying to get to.
Through the chair, I apologize for not understanding the question.
In other words, ultimately the question comes in. You get a $3.95 bill that comes in, and you don't know where that came from. It obviously had to arise out of a contractual relationship with the company, and I believe Senator Coghill's line of questioning was, you know, what obligation should there be if there's a practice that is defrauding the customers? You know, what is your thoughts as a representative of the Attorney General's office of the duty of the company if a situation like that were to develop?
Through the chair, from a consumer perspective, I think that consumers certainly should not have to face charges on their phone bills for services that they did not agree to, and it certainly makes sense that the carriers conduct some kind of process to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I think, I'm not sure exactly what the specifics of that should be, and it may depend on particular carrier, but I think that as I said before, I think that one of the advantages of the bill is that vendors or billing aggregators would be required to produce proof of express authorization to the carriers, and it seems like that would assist the carriers in ensuring that consumers really have agreed to a service before they get billed for it.
I think we're all kind of going in the same direction. Closing words?
I just did want to point out, in speaking to ACS's objection to the bill, that as I referenced last time, that there are already truth in billing guidelines that are recommendations to all telecommunications carriers that you do separate on your bill charges that will result in loss of service and charges that, if not paid, will not result in loss of service. So by separating those two, you're saying pay the local service charge, and if you would like to dispute the third-party charge, then the expectation is that your service will not be cut off if you dispute those charges. Further, that recommendation has been upheld in at least two court cases that I've read in prosecuting cramming that consumers should not have to be investigators of their own phone bill. Two judges have actually found that. And just very quickly, I'd like to read from that letter that Senator Wilikowski was referring to that talks about the 16 attorney generals and their recommendations about phone cramming. Just very quickly, a quote, because the majority of customers do not want third-party charges on their bills, and most are unaware that their telephone bills are vulnerable to such charges, all wireline telephone companies should be required to block third-party billing for all existing and newly enrolled customers by default. The customer should not be burdened with requesting a block, as most customers will not understand the need for such protection until after being victimized by a consumer. So the expectation is if the being victimized by a crammer, somebody who is engaging in cramming.
Victimized by a consumer.
So the expectation is that if the charge is already there, then you have seemingly authorized it, and that's what this bill is aiming to make law, that you authorized it so there will not be issues of shortchanging a telephone company.
Very good. We've come to 3 o'clock. It seems like a bill worth working on, and we will continue to do so. But for today, we are adjourned.